Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and the Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm. Check them out. They got the brand new Instax coming here into the country. Beautiful, really cool little instant photographs. About the size of a business card. Great stuff going on. Pack film, chrome, black and white, you name it. A lot of cool stuff going on with Fujifilm. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all of your C41. They'll develop it. They'll scan it. They'll send you proof. They'll send you the high-res scans back. Great hybrid workflow. RichardPhotoLab.com. Our friends over at DR5, the place for black and white chrome. This is an unbelievable process, and you will not believe your eyes when you see this stuff. When it comes back from Dave Wood, this is beautiful, beautiful proprietary process. Not a little kit that you threw together in the backyard. This is really cool stuff. You got to check them out. www.dr5.com. And our friends over at Iger Studios, the place to get high-res scans done. If you're shooting large format, medium format, 35, it doesn't matter. They have an Aztec Premier. They can scan your film at 8,000 PPI. They can adjust the aperture of the scanner so it can get rid of grain. It doesn't amplify it. You don't have grain aliasing. There's a lot of cool stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. You got to check them out. www.igerstudios.com. Upstrap, for the camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder, over at upstrap-pro.com. Our media partners at the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partners, George Eastman International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Have you got your membership? This is a great deal. This money goes to help maintain the history of photography. If you're into photography, if you're an analog-based photographer, if you're working hybrid workflow, we want to keep this stuff alive so people in future generations can see how this has been done, what's going on. We're losing emulsions every day. This stuff needs to be categorized and put into the museum so people can see what's happened with the history of photography. Check them out, eastmanhouse.org. We got a great show today. We're going to have with us Ron Mowry. Ron's going to talk today about the process of manufacturing film. You know, there's been a lot of discussion on the online boards over at APUG that people think you can just pour an emulsion into a trough and just make some film up. They killed Kodachrome. Well, how come they just can't make some real quick? We're going to go through the process of manufacturing film on the scale that Kodak would do. Fuji, Ilford, this kind of stuff. It's more than people think. So we're going to talk with one of the greatest engineers in photographic history, Ron Mowry. Ron, how you doing today?
Just fine, Scott. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. And today, Ron, we want to talk about manufacturing a film. We both spend a lot of time over at the Analog Photography User Group. There seems to be a lot of people that are down on Kodak right now and Fuji and Ilford and anybody making film thinking that they can just go down and cook up a gallon jug of emulsion, pour it into a trough like they were making taffy candy, and just pull some film out and just sell somebody some Kodachrome or sell them Pan-X or Tecpan or whatever you want that you can't get anymore. And as you well know, and I've seen personally also, this is not the case. Film manufacturing is basically like black art voodoo science. It's like Harry Potter stuff.
You're very close, Scott. Can I describe a coding machine to you?
Let's talk about this. Let's explain this to people so they can actually, for once and finally, get a grip and a grasp of what's going on here.
Okay. A coating machine coats a sheet of film or paper at Kodak 42 inches wide. There is a 1-inch track down each side that's no good. And this is because there are rollers that support the film or paper as it goes through the machine that must not make contact with the coated area. So the coated area is only 40 and a fraction inches wide, and then you have about a 1-inch undercut roller on each side, and the film travels over that and keeps the undercut away from the actual coated emulsion. And at the very edges, I say it's 40 inches and a fraction wide, because surface tension causes the emulsion bead to pull away from the center and to create a little kind of like a ridge at the very edges. So if you look at a piece of coated emulsion, full width, it looks perfectly uniform for 40 inches across the center. Then you have two little bumps at the edge, and then you have a little bit less than an inch of uncoated film or paper at the edges. That's the way it looks. Now, for the machine itself, imagine you're in a typical warehouse, because this is what the coating room looks like, a big warehouse. But it's completely grounded in absorbing pillars of concrete to keep this building from shaking. Because believe me, there's heavy traffic going by on the streets outside. So this building is shock absorber equipped to prevent the coating machine from shaking. The machine goes from floor to ceiling. The support, 42 inches wide, travels in a sinusoidal path from floor to ceiling around rollers. At one end, when the base is in contact with the roller is full width. At the other end, when the roller is in contact with the emulsion side, it's an undercut roller that only touches the very inch edges of the paper or film. That's called the selvage edge, by the way. So anyhow, you've got this sinusoidal path that travels the whole length of this warehouse and then turns and does a right angle and comes back to the beginning. And then goes through a complete sinusoidal path again. The reason for this is to get the optimum long length of drying, to dry and condition the emulsion, because it has to come out of the coating machine perfectly dry. Now, among other things, you got to understand that until the dryness has reached a certain point, if you turn a corner, the emulsion's going to slide right off of the support. So you either have to chill set the emulsion in a long flat section first before you turn the first corner or you're in trouble, or you have to have a very long drying session that makes the emulsion stiff enough that when you turn the first corner, you're not going to fling it off with centrifugal force or you're not going to allow it to start to slide. Have I been clear so far?
Oh, completely.
Okay. Now, you can't just start this machine up because it's not a roller transport machine. You can't just plug it in and turn it on. You've got to have it threaded with something to start it up. Now, if that machine's path length is a mile long, it's got a mile of leader in there. If the machine coats a mile of film, you've got to thread it with leader, which means you've got to have another mile of leader ready to thread the machine with at the end. So to coat a 1 mile track of film, you have to have 3 miles of film support. Now, to be sure, you can reuse the leader and trailer over and over and over again, but it's much simpler to just re-thread the machine with the next product that's coming down the pipeline. You see that too, right?
Right.
So if you're in continuous production, you don't need this re-threading of the machine. You just start it up and keep making production, and the last film or paper that you made becomes the leader for the next film that you're going to make. And that film becomes the leader for the next one, and you just keep going. Now, the only thing you have to do is change a few dials on the machine to optimize it for the next product. And if each product requires a slight change in temperature, well, let's imagine that this one requires 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the next one 95, and the next one 100. You'd schedule them in order, and you just turn the temperature up for each one. You see what I'm saying?
Right, and people don't realize that when this coating process is going on, this film isn't creeping by at 3 feet per minute.
No. Yeah, let me go back to that. That machine that was shown in the Dutch Kodak presentation, you met some of the people at that lunch that we had. As best they can date it, it might be from in the 40s. So even though it purports to be from the late 50s, or maybe 60s even, it comes from the 40s. That machine was running at about 10 feet a minute. Kodak made another jump to about 100 feet a minute with an improved type of coating machine that used extrusion. Then they made a jump to over 500 feet a minute with a slide hopper. And then when they came to the curtain coater, they found that the maximum speed of the slide hopper coater was the minimum speed for the curtain coater. So, I mean, they're putting film through there very, very fast.
So we're talking in excess of 500 feet per minute. Probably talking, closer to 750 to 1,000.
You're talking in excess of 1,000.
Right. So even at 1,000 feet per minute, doing a simple calculation, that this stuff's traveling like 50, 60 miles an hour.
Well, a master roll is 5 minutes.
Okay, 5,000 feet. So there you go.
Okay. Now, for each run, when you strike the bead, you have startup and you have shutdown. That is, at the beginning, that bead from the curtain coater or the slide coater is not perfect. It has little bubbles in it and streaks and everything like that. And the best way to get that started is to do it in the light. And just like motion picture, you've heard them say speed. I don't know if you've ever heard that old expression.
yep,
that speed the cameras up to full speed. Well, the coding machine goes to full speed, too. When we go by that machine, I've been by the front end of the hopper, going at around 500 feet a minute, quite a bit under what its full speed is. And the coding operator is striking the bead from the slide hopper. This hopper is 42 inches wide. It weighs several tons, and it's on a hydraulic jack, if you will, that he can move forward or back with a lever. And he'll move it forward, and the bead will strike. And if it strikes and it's perfect, they go. If it doesn't, he has a little pick there that looks like a guitar pick, and he tries to get the bubbles out of the hopper. He has a couple of things he can spray it with and mist it with and pull the lever back and forth and back and forth. He's a master engineer, and he knows what he's doing. When that bead strikes, he knows it's perfect. You'll hear him yell, "Lights, speed," and boy, it goes dark. And you hear this machine going rumble, 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 and it's picking up speed to full speed. It's also coding what we call in between, because that's not good stuff. And then he reaches full speed, and from there on, for the rest of the day, he's expected to code perfect stuff. Do you see the point?
Yep.
Now, if he's only coding one master roll of Kodachrome, he's got in between right there, and he's got in between at the end, and he's got in between for the next product, because you've got to go through it twice. That's one of the other problems. So you have loss. You have loss of the following product, and you have loss of the product that you're coding. So if you want one full master roll, you actually have to code probably 1 2/10 master rolls.
Note here that these are 42 inches by 5,000 feet, but a 5,000-foot roll of this material is, what, 18 feet in diameter?
Well, it's taller than I am. I would say it's probably 10 to 15 feet in diameter. That is huge forklifts at the end of the machine, plus a very fast cut-and-splice machine that is set up to sense the end of a master roll. And when it reaches the end, I've seen this thing go. You don't want to be standing in front of it. It'd take your arm off. It literally zips across, cuts the joint, splices in the film coming out onto the next core while the previous core is being lifted away with about a ton and a half or whatever it weighs of finished product. And then that forklift goes zooming away with its little operator sitting on his little seat with his white suit on, and he runs it up and puts it into cold store. And at the same time, guys come running up and they cut the end off of that and they send that off to testing. So they have an end sample. Now, I know there's been some comment about, oh, it takes so much time. I think Mirko's commented on APUG that he has to wait for his hardener to set up. The interesting thing is that Kodak's hardener sets up very fast. And so the reason I was going to mention this is that I have gotten core samples. Well, I guess I shouldn't call them core samples, but samples from the end of film or paper that came right off the end of the machine and carried them back to research and processed them and ran them at, these were 88 degree processes with no pre-hardener, and they were just fine. So we have a very fast hardener, and I've mentioned that and alluded to it on APUG before. If you've got a hardener that sets up that fast, you can't stop the machine. You see, there are miles and miles of tubing. If you have six layers, you've got six sets of tubing that come from these great big kettles. And since a kettle could be conceivably emptied during one make, one run, you have to have two sets of kettles, or maybe three. And each one of those entail more insulated stainless steel tubing. And if you had to shut the machine down and the hardener were mixed with that, you've lost all of that tubing, and you have to disassemble the whole thing and throw away the tubing. You can't push it out, because this is special passivated stainless steel. It cannot be scratched. So you can't run a reamer through here and push the gelatin out, because there's fear of scratching the passivation, or destroying it, at least. What you have to do is replace it. In fact, none of the joints are screw joints. The joints are all compression fittings with a clamp and O-rings, so that there's no way that a screw thread can either be plugged by leakage or be destroyed in its passivation or resistance to emulsion chemistry. So it's a very complex operation with miles of pipes.
It is. I've seen it. Trust me. Especially in the area where the emulsion comes down below the coating room that's on this concrete pillar that goes into bedrock underneath Building 38. Like you said, there's enough pots there where the emulsion that's been mixed by the robotic equipment, that's brought back into cold storage. When they dump it in to heat the gelatin up, then it runs through the filter and then gets delivered to the coater. There's 20 plus of these things because, like you said, there's redundancy. It's quite impressive. And like you said, there's hundreds of miles of stainless tubing.
Yes. And if you look at the slide hopper or the curtain hopper, 42 inches wide, what you have to do is to have a constant delivery all the way across that 40 inches. It's got to be absolutely perfect. You can't have any high spots or low spots in the delivery of melted emulsion. This requires a lot of very precise pumping, a lot of very precise orifices. The old extrusion hoppers were called J machines or Joe Block machines because they used very precision ground metal plates to grind the extrusion hoppers to make sure that they were flat. The current hoppers are aligned and ground with lasers. The smaller hoppers are packed like they were the Hope Diamond in a blue velvet wood case. Because I've worked with the smaller hoppers for the smaller machines, and we had to change hoppers on one of my jobs, and the guy wheeled it out on a very special dolly, and he said, "Now we have to take the old one off, Ron, and we got to put the new one on." And he opened it up like he was going to reveal to me a major piece of jewelry. And it was probably in that price range, I would say.
Sure.
As for the coating machines, they are completely enclosed. They are not open. This is to keep air out of the drying cabinets because any dust will cause a coating defect. So they keep dust out of it rigorously. Any place the film has to be supported, it's done with air bearings on the front and back of the film. And you can see this can't happen until the emulsion is set up enough that it can withstand that air pressure. So the emulsion is under constant positive pressure, traveling at high speed. That air pressure cannot develop any harmonics. I've actually been in a coating room when a small harmonic developed because somebody opened a door when they shouldn't have or something, and the film moved forward, hit the surface of the air plenum, stuck to it because it was still wet enough. The whole thing ripped, and the coating machine went into shutdown. And what a mess. Well, it would have cut us in half with the high-speed paper traveling this high speed all over the room. It was stuck to walls, the floor, the ceiling, everything.
What a mess.
Well, the paper piling up pushed the doors open to the drying cabinets and then just started to rip and fly.
Right, because it's moving that fast. I mean, that's a lot of inertia, a lot of paper, a lot of weight, and it's just going to keep pushing, man. It's hydraulic. I mean, it's just going to move. It's going to move metal. It's going to move people. It's going to move whatever's in its way.
I heard the fellow scream and yell, "Lights, stop, all stop," or whatever it was he yelled. I was in a panic because I didn't know what happened. And it was total darkness, and I'm getting hit by all this gooey stuff. And the lights went on, and there was confetti everywhere. And I turned to the chief engineer, and I said, "How long is it going to take him to get it operational?" And he started to laugh. He said, "It better only take him a half hour." But I knew it took him longer.
Right.
It was a job. And I know from personal experience because I've miscalculated on my coating structure and I've had the emulsion not chill set properly. And when it went around the first bend, it just started to slide off the support and pile up in the bottom of the coating cabinet. And I got a call from Paul, the chief coater. He said, "Ron, come on in and bring your putty knife." And I took him seriously because you take the engineer seriously. I went in at around 9 o'clock at night and got home around midnight or one or two. So, yeah, we cleaned up a mess.
You know, everybody thinks that Kodak or anybody can just pump out some emulsion on wheel. And, well, how come they don't make some more Kodachrome? Let's take TechPan as an example. Let's say I'm going to buy a whole master roll. And I want Kodak to make it, slit it, box it, and deliver me a truckload full of film. Do you think they'd even do it?
I can't answer that question with assurance either way. All I can do is tell you how difficult it is. First off, to make an emulsion is going to cost several thousand dollars because they're going to have to use several kilograms of silver.
Right.
So they're going to have to make enough emulsion to make at least one master roll plus a little bit more. Now, I can't say exactly how much it's going to take, but let's say it takes 500 liters of emulsion. A kilogram per mole, that's going to take 500 times 100 is 5,000 grams of silver. 5 kilos, did I get that right?
Yep.
So let's say it takes 5 kilograms of silver nitrate, That's probably around $5,000 worth of silver nitrate right there. They've got to make a 1 mile roll of support. I don't know how much support costs, but I can say that a mile of coating on a narrow width machine, that's an 11-inch or a 5-inch machine, is going to run about the same amount of money. I'd put it around $25,000 just for the run. So if you came into Kodak and said, make me 1 mile of 5-inch wide or 11-inch wide tech pan, they're going to say, all right, labor, cost of the machine, utilities, the 11-inch film, if we got it on stock, everything is going to run you around $25,000 plus the emulsion if we have it. If we don't have it, it's going to cost you another X thousand dollars. I don't see people stepping forward with $25,000.
And like you said, I bet you they wouldn't make it for 25. I bet you it'd cost you 100 by the time it was cut and coated and boxed, and they're going to give you a deliverable.
Well, that was the next step I was going to take you. If you wanted a delivered product, I think it would run you about $100,000 for one master roll. Now, it's not going to cost you $200,000 for two master rolls, though.
No.
And it's not going to cost you a proportionate amount for three master rolls. It's going to go up in tinier amounts the more you make, you see? But that's obvious. The more cars you make, the cheaper they get.
Well, let's talk about this. Master roll, 40 inches of available material times 5,000 feet less liter and takeoff and so forth and so on, is going to net, what, maybe 30,000 rolls of 35?
Yeah, about 30,000 rolls.
Okay, so 30,000 rolls, you're talking 100 grand, you're still talking probably $3 a roll.
Yeah.
Plus or minus, and the stuff used to sell for, what, $5, $6?
Yeah.
That's about normal profit for Kodak, 100%?
Don't forget, you got to go through the dealers and everybody else.
Right, so there's the deal. Here's the thing. If you made 30,000 rolls of tech pan tomorrow, you couldn't sell it. There wouldn't be enough people that would buy it.
No.
So guess what? Maybe that's why Kodak doesn't make it.
Well, you see, that's the problem. If I give a hypothetical example, this is totally hypothetical, you understand, but let's say that you coat a product one master roll every year, and you sell it in a year. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Sure, why not?
Okay, so this is a hypothetical example. You find at the end of that year, instead of having sold it all, not only do you have a couple of hundred feet left on your master roll that you haven't sold in the plant, you're getting your photo dealers saying, hey, this film is expiring on the shelf because we have some left over from last year. We haven't been able to sell it. Can we return it to you? Kodak says, well, no, sell it at a loss or do what you can.
Plus, look at the way the distribution chain is now with Kodak. Kodak used to sell direct to everybody. You could be Joe's Camera Shop and order $100 worth of product from Kodak and they would ship it to you. Guess what? That doesn't happen anymore. You have to go through a distributor.
Yeah.
And the problem being now is, if you look at distributor pricing and what's going on with the distribution chain in Kodak, that I don't blame them one bit on what they're doing. Okay? Because it's just the right way to do distribution, to go through master distributors to the end reseller, and then to the consumer, okay? That's how distribution works. You can't sell to every Jane Doe and whoever you want that's going to buy something, but Kodak used to do that. They've been doing that since 1900 or probably before, okay?
Yes.
Well, here's the problem. I have a wholesale price sheet. It's cheaper for me as a camera shop, okay, to go to B&H and buy it than buy it from my distributor.
I believe it. And I can give you an example of the way it used to be. Well, I should say, I worked my way through college in a photo finishers, and my boss wanted to buy one of the first boxes of Type C paper from Kodak in the Pittsburgh area and process it and see if he could set up a line to deliver people custom 8x10s. And I can remember a 25-sheet box cost nearly $50.
It's a lot of money back in
1955.
It's a lot of jack back then.
Yep. Okay, so what happened? He ordered it, and a 25-sheet pack of Type C Kodak paper was delivered to his door, hand-delivered by a guy in a little Kodak truck. They had a delivery system in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And they had a little shop, the Kodak shop, up on, I'm trying to remember the road, but it was right near the Liberty Tubes in Pittsburgh, and they shipped it right out of there, and it was refrigerated. It came in, it was cold. And he said, put this into the refrigerator right away. It doesn't keep, and we had our little refrigerator there that we stuck it in. And that's the way Kodak used to deal. We call them up, say, we need this. Kodak would drive the little truck down and deliver it right to our shop. And so, yes, it worked, but not in today's modern world.
No.
So we go back to you making a master roll. I think it's going to run $100,000, but here's the hypothetical example, if we can go back to it. So you found that in 1 year you didn't sell that roll, but up until now you've been selling a roll a year. So you go back to the bean counters and they say, yeah, it looks like we're only selling a roll every year and a half. So you reschedule this product to be made every year and a half. And for 2-3 years, every year and a half, sure enough, you run out of it. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, you find that you've got a couple hundred feet left on inventory, and the dealers are again saying, can we return some to you? Sales have gone down again. So you say, maybe we should coat it every other year, every 2 years. And as soon as you do that, you find that even at 2 years, you got leftover product. And at 3 years, you got leftover product. And finally, your prognosticators say, hey, it's going to spoil in your refrigerated warehouse before it's all sold. And there's when you run into a problem.
Yep, your own product has gone bad on your own shelf. And this is because of one reason and one reason only. The public is not buying it.
Yes. Now we go back and they say, well, it's because Kodak doesn't advertise or because they don't push it. Kodak's last ad that I can find was for the Winter Olympics in 1990, I believe it was.
Okay.
It showed a picture of a skier splashing snow up onto the purported cameraman in the picture. And it had E6 films and Kodachrome advertised in the same ad. Kodak made an experimental 400-speed Kodachrome. And they gave out samples, and the people that tested it, Popular Photog, Modern Photog, all of these magazines back in 1988, something like that, said, ho-hum. So Kodak said, what are we going to do? We can't sell it. Nobody wants it. We sent samples out to other people, famous photographers. They didn't want it. So the project was canceled. There were a number of projects that got canceled back then because photography, it was kind of like in a let's wait and see. But the amateur product sold like hotcakes. Color negative film, everything. This is why Kodak built Building 38 back in that time frame, because they needed the productivity. They built new paper coating machines, everything. Demand for paper, film, everything was climbing sky high. They built a new factory in Brazil because they expected to have black and white and color paper in Brazil. They laid the groundwork for the plant in China. I knew several of the people involved in it. Then it turned out that everybody leaped right over black and white paper, black and white film, color paper. They leaped right over it to go for digital. This wasn't Kodak's fault. They didn't know what to do. They were caught in an enormous downturn in product that occurred at a rate that was 4 times greater than anybody had predicted.
I think you can blame it on Kodak because they created the digital camera. So if you want to put the ultimate blame on Kodak, but here's the thing. If Kodak didn't invent it, someone else would have.
Well, there's an interesting story about that. Do you remember the Mavica?
Yep.
Okay. The Mavica was a black and white camera that used a DVD or something like it.
A floppy disk. Actually, I don't have a Mavica, but I have the Canon one that was almost like a video still image. So it was pre-digital and it would take a video still and record it on a little miniature floppy. But the Mavica was a true, and I think it was probably video too. They were recording a still image, but it was on a floppy disk, yes.
Well, I have to tell you the story about that. At the same time that Mavica, black and white as it was, and floppy disk as it was invented by Sony, Kodak had a color version that instantly popped the image up onto an LCD at the back.
Really?
Just like today's cameras. And it was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. I've seen it. I've held it. In any event, Sony took Kodak aside at one of the World Trade Conferences and said, well, what do you think of this? And showed him the black and white, the floppy disk. They took it out, put it into a computer, and the image popped up. And Kodak said, what do you think of this? Click color. And Sony withheld their announcement of this particular product that they had at the time. We were afraid Kodak was going to announce it. And I guess when Kodak didn't announce it, they decided we had enough problems, and they went on and announced their product. I don't know the details after that, but the Japanese were quite surprised. Kodak has some very valuable digital properties right now.
Well, sure. I mean, I think they're making money off of everybody that makes a digital camera. The problem is, here's the example. Let's say they make $3 on each roll of film profit, okay?
Yeah.
I bet you they don't make $3 on an EasyShare camera.
No, they don't.
So here's the problem is, you know, they used to make millions and millions of rolls of film and make $3 a pop. Wow, we're in Fat City. Rochester was rocking. Now they're shipping container loads of digital cameras over and they're making $3 a container.
Well, that may very well be true. I don't know, but I can say that Kodak's invented several new types of sensors lately that have been featured in the news locally. I don't know how successful they're going to be, but they also have some very nice OLED, organic light emitting diode technology that
those
they're working on.
Those are beautiful picture frames. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and they have a lot of this new, much less expensive printer ink that they've come out with. If people continue to print, then the Kodak printer inks are really going to be a big breakthrough for Kodak.
Right. Well, the problem is, I think there's even a downturn of people printing even in their own home with their little inkjets.
Yes.
People just aren't making prints, and you don't have a photograph until you have a print.
Yeah, but you have to ask yourself a question. Is this due to the market downturn that we're in the middle of? Or is it due to people's preferences?
People's preferences. I honestly think that people are sticking pictures up on Facebook, up on MySpace, LinkedIn. They're twitting the stuff. They're putting them online. They're putting them on their websites. I mean, I love to hold a photograph in my hand and look at it, especially black and white and silver. And I mean, yes, it's great. But even you, Ron, how many pictures do you print anymore versus what you take? You shoot some digital? You shoot analog and scan it? When it's scanned, do you print the stuff out? Does it go online? I mean, here's the question. Is everything printed?
Well, I buy digital paper in 500-sheet boxes, and I have probably close to 1,000 sheets of Endura paper in my freezer. So you have to say I'm a print lover, whether it's digital or analog. I have boxes of prints here.
That's the thing. You don't have a photograph until you have a print. You can't really sell a digital file. You can't hang a digital file on the wall. You got to have a print. And I think people, they're not printing. You're not seeing refrigerators stuck full of pictures anymore like you used to. And I think that the family source, the wives, the mothers, the females are the image gatherers and the keepers of memories. And yeah, they're using an easier camera. Maybe they're printing some out with their little dock is cool, but they're just not doing prints like they used to.
Well, sure. And if you use a photograph, for example, as your desktop, I bet you do, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, do you leave your desktop turned on all the time, or does your computer go idle and black?
Mine's almost on. If I'm not around it, it goes idle and black, but mainly it's on.
Okay, well, mine is on, but it's idle and black because I don't want to stress the screen.
Right.
It does eventually burn out.
Sure.
And it'll get little defects on it or something. So I don't see that picture right now. My computer is sitting there, and it's black. It's got a little blinking light on it that says it's in standby mode. And that's the way it works for me.
I don't think that it's anything to do with Kodak or people that love film or analog photography. I just think that we're in this digital age. And I think that's one thing, too, is the younger people now that are doing photography, that might be doing event photography, they're just having fun. There's actually this resurgence in the use of film and analog technologies because you know why? They're stuck at a computer 24/7 and they're just sick and tired of a computer.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I would like to make a comment about that. There are several young people from APUG that have contacted me for help. I can't help them directly. For example, I can't send them chemicals. That's illegal. They're teenagers, and I can't help them directly in the lab because that's not appropriate. But I can give them advice, and I could give advice to their teachers. And it's good to see teachers out there that are encouraging their students to do analog photo assignments in a scientific environment and using the scientific method. And this is going to keep analog photography alive. I really wish them all the best.
Exactly. And I think in another program here, we're going to talk about the work that you've been doing with the people at the George Eastman House and how you guys have monthly meetings and you get together about keeping these historic analog processes together. And I think it's very important that people practice this. And we're all hoping that film lives forever, but I think if you just look at it on an economic basis, I think film will be available forever. It's just a matter of what's going to be available.
Yes, you can't actually say analog is dead, right, Scott?
Oh, no. No, you can't because, I mean, here's the thing. I can go out and do wet plate. I can go contact Mark Osterman over at the Eastman House and have him teach me how to do wet plate. And I don't need any film. I don't need to buy anything. I need some yummy chemicals on a piece of glass. I can make analog photography forever.
Yes. Oh, Mark's photographs are absolutely gorgeous.
They are. They're beautiful. I saw them. I saw his positives white on a piece of glass. This stuff's unbelievable.
Yep, yep. You should see his personal photography and his studio and some of the work that his wife does.
Yeah, they're great.
They're a terrific team.
And I think what's going on in the Eastman house is great, and them trying to replicate these original analog processes and teach people how to do it and curators and what they're doing. The problem is you have a small company that's making film, and they have a small coder. They'll probably stay alive forever. You'll be able to buy some kind of black and white film. We'll be way dead. They'll still be able to buy film, okay?
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you look at these big corporations like Fuji and Kodak, Fuji will probably make film longer than Kodak just for the sake of saying they did. I don't know. They claim they'll be the last one standing when it comes to film. But, I mean, look at the market with Kodak. What happens if all movie theaters tomorrow went digital? Kodak would lose all their business in film.
Yeah, and it would affect Kodak more than it would Fuji.
Sure, it would, because Fuji has a very small market share in motion picture. Kodak's got 95% of the market. Now, yes, people are still going to want to shoot film. There's great digital technologies to do motion picture with the Red camera and all the stuff that's going on. But there's certain people in the industry want to capture analog. But if distribution goes digital, Kodak's not going to make 16 billion miles of film like they do in building 14 and 38 for all this print film that's going to go to theaters. And I think it's going to get to the point to where when that happens, they're going to stop making that. The bean counter is going to be a check mark on a sheet. Kill film. Bang. And that's it.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's probably what's going to happen unless they can capture
a resurgence in young people. And I think it comes back to, Ron, the marketing. They're not marketing film.
Well, I have personal opinions about that. And I really feel the guy out there that's stuck in between both worlds is Scott DeSabato.
Poor Scott. I feel sorry for Scott. He's my buddy, and he wants to do all this stuff, and he's such a passionate photographer, and he loves film, but he's in this environment.
Yes, he's stuck between two worlds, and he's doing a terrific job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's doing a terrific job, but he's got the limits that the company has said, thus far will you go and no further. And so he can't go beyond a certain limit that's been established by those above him.
I mean, I want to go out and tell everybody that digital is garbage. Throw it in the trash can and go buy a roll of film. Poor Scott can't do that because guess what? That's another business unit of Kodak. And you can't say that the left's doing the right and the right's garbage and the left is better.
Yeah, that's right. You can point out, though, that analog will always capture an image more faithfully than digital as long as the sensors in digital are side by side and not stacked. Okay?
Well, that's why we look at a Phobion sensor and go, ooh, very interesting technology.
Well, you know that then.
Oh, yeah. I have two Sigma cameras. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is that digital sensors are made using optical and photographic techniques. The templates for making the digital sensors, the etching materials and everything, are photosensitive materials. And they are limited in making a line or a mark in this silicon wafer or etching, of a certain size. That size is limited by the photographic capability of the material used. Right now, many of the etchings are done using UV-sensitive materials.
Right.
The liquid materials that they put on, and then they'll etch a layer with UV light, then put on some more and etch another layer and so forth. And that's how they build up the wafer. I'm not an expert at this, so I'm not describing it perfectly right. But the idea is that the resolution of that sensor can only be as good as the photo material. So the better you make a photo material, the better the sensor is going to be. Do you follow that argument?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if that photo material is limited to, now I'm just making this up, 5 microns, then that sensor can only be as good as a 5-micron crystal of silver halide.
But the problem being is silver halide is much smaller than 5 micron.
Oh, I can make silver halide grains down to 0.02 microns.
So guess what? It's not there yet.
They're not going to be as fast. They're going to be a lot slower. But they sure as heck are going to beat it for grain and sharpness. You see?
Well, sure. Look at some of these films like ADOC CMS-20. It's 20 ISO and you shoot at 14, but the resolution is unbelievable.
And there is my point being made. Until digital, let's say, uses that type of technology, to get the equivalent of, let's say, a 0.1 micron sensor, then they're not going to be able to get that type of resolution.
They're not even close yet.
Now, I'm certainly not the best person to describe any of these things. I'm just a person willing to talk to you. But there are a lot of people who have a lot more knowledge about this, about photosystem engineering, about coding machines, than I do. And I have to give them all the credit that they're due right here and now. And I'm just trying to say that in my own way, digital has a long way to go to catch up with analog.
So true. I mean, it's great. Digital's fun. Certain things you can do with it, depending on the application. I mean, what are you going to say about it? It's a neat technology, but it's still not there and it cannot replace the analog process. And we just hope that things work out where younger people want to actually get involved in shooting analog and playing around with film and cross-processing and just going crazy. But consequently, it's just a bad situation. I mean, look at what's going on at RIT. I was out there a few weeks ago, and they've gone from 100-something darkrooms down to like 15. And the place, it's horrible. It's so depressing. It's just, you want to just leave, even though the place is depressing to start with.
They won't let the students do their own color processing anymore.
I bet not.
They say that the chemistry is too toxic.
It's not that toxic. Come on.
No, it isn't.
Then it gets into the deal where, okay, well, now the tree huggers are jumping in and just saying that it's too toxic. We can't touch it. I mean, you can do C41 at home. You can do it without even touching any chemical. And consequently, you could probably do K14. Isn't that toxic? Maybe I'm wrong, but nevertheless, it can't be that bad for you.
K14 is not really more toxic than C41 or E6. I would say that it's 30% more toxic or something on that order because it uses three developers. That's about it.
Right, but it's not like soaking your hands in mercury.
Well, or cyanide.
Still, a little cyanide won't hurt anybody. Just make sure you don't soak your hands in the stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they use cyanide as a fixer for dry plate.
Oh, yeah, tintypes. All that stuff uses cyanide.
Yeah.
So you can still buy it, and it works fine. They use cyanide to do electroplating gold. There's a lot of processes that use cyanide. I don't see people dying every 5 seconds. You just don't soak your hands in the stuff. But consequently, I guess the government and people figure that the American public and even the world public are so stupid that they have to make the stuff so you can drink it, otherwise they won't come near it.
Well, yeah. Do you know that it's illegal to buy sodium hydroxide on the island of Manhattan?
Really?
Well, that's what I was told.
I can believe it.
The law was enacted when some idiot threw lye in the face of an actress and disfigured her back in the 30s. This is a story I got when I was asked to do a workshop there, and I gave them a list of chemicals of what they had to have. And they had the greatest difficulty getting sodium hydroxide.
I just hope that people continue to enjoy the analog process and even investigate some of these older type processes because you can make some great stuff. I mean, look, they can buy some of your emulsions and coat their own film. They don't have to be relying on a monster conglomerate corporations to make film. You can make it yourself.
Yeah, well, a simple 4x5 film coater or a plate coater would be about the size of a single car garage. And if you put extra drying capacity in there to speed the operation up, it would be a two-car garage. I could make 4x5, 8x10 plates or 4x5 film and stock up a little supply there and run off 100 feet a minute, I'd say, of film. If I could build a machine, the machine would probably cost around $10,000 at the low end, $50,000 median, depending on capacity. So there you are.
So let's say we build one, but here's our problem. Who's going to buy our film?
Well, yeah, I know how much I've invested already in the emulsion making project. It cost me a pretty penny to make the coating blades, make all these emulsions and get them working right. It was not an easy or inexpensive job.
No, and the problem is let's use a theoretical deal that we can start cranking out film tomorrow and it's all good. And Freestyle is going to buy it and B&H is going to stock it and all these guys are going to buy it for ultra large format.
Uh-huh.
We're going to be able to coat enough in a year, probably in one afternoon at a barbecue. Boom. Hey, Ron, we made enough film for a year. Great. Cool.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So now people maybe can understand why, and they get all mad at Kodak and Fuji and all these other guys for stopping to make their favorite film. And you got to look at it that these aren't super rich people that are just doing this because they like it. These are corporations that have to make money, or the shareholders will eliminate them from the board of directors. And the board of directors don't want to get eliminated. So the president and CEO has to make sure the people down the line don't cause him any problems.
You're exactly right. And here is another problem they have to face, too, that's kind of hidden. I've mentioned it on APUG. There are probably only 200 living photographic engineers worldwide, and that includes Fuji, Agfa, Ilford, Kodak, and so forth. And so as analog winds down, who's going to teach those that come after us unless we all try to write books? And 99% of us are not interested in writing books.
I would think 99% of you want to just go have fun and don't talk to me about film. Because for you, you're into it, but a lot of the guys are like, it's work. I don't want to talk about that, man.
Yeah, I talked to a friend of mine about chemical sensitization. This is something that is way outside of my specialty, and I don't know too much about it. I've done some, and I do them here at home, and I teach my students. But I called this guy, said, are you interested? And he said, Ron, I'm about to go down to my cabin on the lake. He said, I don't even want to talk about it. It's too much like work. I want to forget it.
If you had a bag of cash for him, then he would sit down and talk. But just to preserve this or to learn or share his knowledge, he's like, go away, man.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't even think that some of these would be willing to work for cash.
Well, there you go.
Because I've talked to some of them and said, well, if we did this, we could probably set up a consultancy because there is a market for it, and yet they're not interested. Nope. So I think that many of them wouldn't even do it for money.
Everybody's got a vice, so I'm sure you could get them to do it somehow. But consequently, like you said, it's going to be very difficult to preserve this process. And I think that's why the work that's going on with the George Eastman House and Mark and those guys down there, what you're helping these guys with to preserve these things. But like you said, you can't get blood out of a turnip.
Yes, you're right. That's why the work with Mark and myself may become more important as time goes on. Mark and I have to get together this summer to do a number of things that we've been talking about and delaying. We really want to get to it, but he's been so tied up with his job, and I've been so tied up with the stuff here that we just haven't gotten to it. Well, let's talk about that next time. How's that?
We will. We'll talk about it on our next show about what you guys are doing on how to preserve this beautiful analog process and just be able to teach people in the future how to make great photography. So, Ron, you got the DVD coming out. You got the book that I've seen now is in the fourth transitional point, the fourth edition that you've been revving this down to. You do a lot of great work. You spend an enormous amount of time answering questions for people on APUG. And I guess the best place to see what you're up to is just to go to apug.org and look for Photo Engineer, yeah?
Yep, that's about it.
That's great. And we're going to have more information about what you're up to and people will be able to contact you and all this other stuff moving forward. But I do, again, appreciate you taking time to discuss this issue that keeps coming up over and over again about, well, how come they just can't make a little quick roll of film so we can have our little film? Sell your house, buy a master roll, and tell us when you have it for sale, and we'll buy it from you. What a great deal.
Oh, thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks, Ron. I really appreciate it, buddy. We look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Well, there you go. Ron Mowry. A lot of great information with Ron. He's just a cool guy. A lot of stuff going on he's working on. And just great to hear about how this process works to actually manufacture film and how this voodoo black art is really done and what it takes to make this kind of emulsion and why people really don't think about it. But this is just some great information from Ron. Cool stuff. Definitely check out his work over at apug.org. I've been your host here, Scott Shepard on Inside Analog Photo. And of course, we've been brought to you by our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org. Our photographic philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film. Of course, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Fujifilm USA over at fujifilmusa.com/professional. They got the Instax in, great stuff. Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. DR5 at dr5.com. And Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, you can find out more information about the program over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.